Hi, I'm Paul Lisnick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain.
30 is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America. There is not a black America and a white America and Latino America and Asian America. There's the United States of America.
Remember those days? It seems like centuries ago, doesn't it? But that, of course, was former President Barack Obama at the 2004 Democratic Convention when he spoke of unity and he spoke of the need to draw the lines away between black and white and red and blue and pulling us all together as Americans. Things have changed, I think, since those days. But let's talk about those days, because a new book is out called Obama, An Oral History, 2009 to 2017. It is written by Brian Abrams, who has quite the name for himself in the world of pop culture and mass culture. I still got to read his book about David Letterman and others, but he joins us now to talk about his latest venture in the world of Obama. Brian, welcome to the podcast here on WGN.
Hello, how are you?
I am good. So I know you've been touring. You were on my Politics Tonight show. You were here in our WGN news as well. What's been the reaction to a book that looks back at the Obama years now that we're well into a Trump presidency?
Interesting question, and one that I haven't heard in a while. I have kind of a loaded answer for you, really.
Go for it. It's a podcast.
Because the timing of the release of this book, this oral history, where essentially I piece together the last decade of politics and policy through 112, 113 on-record interviews. So it's a story being told through quotes, essentially, of the Obama presidency. When we dropped the book in July of this year, this was at a time when, how do I say this? Obama was not in the spotlight. There was a magazine cover from New York Magazine asking, "Where is Obama?" You have President Trump in the New York Times headlines no longer really being referred to for shuffling around in his bathrobe, right, and going upstairs at 6 p.m. The narrative slightly changed, and especially after Trump kind of had this regime change in May where Gary Cohn is gone, and McMaster and Tillerson are gone, and all these guys who were kind of roadblocks to whatever his incoherent vision was. And sadly, Trump was sort of, this is accepted as the president, no longer as like sort of the rookie running around the White House.
Well, as he also learned the game himself.
Well, I think he knows the you know, the news game, and he knows the media game. He's not interested in policy. I'm just to answer honestly, it was a difficult time to release a book when everyone was sort of frantically obsessed with, you know, what Trump was up to, which is always going to be the case. But now that we see Obama sort of hitting the campaign trail for some people for the midterms, you know, I'm beginning to get the feeling, at least out there in the public and in the media, for the Obama crave that I think people wanted. You know, that would have aligned much better with the launch of the book.
Well, there really is an interesting answer, because the answer I expected was along those lines of that, you know, you had to have packed rooms and packed audiences for people who at this point in the game just want a breath of fresh air from the past. I'm talking about the people who are not Trump supporters, and behind him, obviously, you weren't going to have a lot of Trumpers show up with a happy smile on their face. But let me ask you, so an oral history, you defined this at the beginning of that answer, but this is an unusual or at least a different take on a book. So I think it's important. I mean, I've had other Obama book authors on my shows before, and people think they're about to read a biography. An oral history is a very different animal. So while you referenced it up front, let's be real clear about what an oral history is.
Sure. And I should correct my previous answer. You're right. I went to 6 or 7 cities for this book tour, and the turnouts were really good in all of these. There's always been a craving for, at least as you mentioned, on the Democratic and on the liberal side, for a sort of responsible presidency, or at least an administration that embraces the concepts of big government and being there to help people and not just sort of this, rich get richer scheme that is always been part of the GOP agenda, and that now Trump is sort of the head of that snake, and adding a little more authoritarianism on top. So the oral history and how it's distinct from your typical Washington book, I would just say that you look at, say, the new Bob Woodward, all of his material is gathered from sources on background, meaning, he is writing a typical prose book, paragraph by paragraph, and the information he is receiving is from his sources, people on the Hill, people in the White House who don't want their name attributed to it.
And people might think that's an oral history when your book is written from all those people you've talked to. It is, but that's not what you did.
Right. I mean, and that's fine, by the way. That's the only way they're going to talk to him. But my case was I had to get all of these people on the record where you're reading their quotes. You're essentially reading a book of quotes that drives a story. It's not a scrapbook. It's an actual story where you're kind of being fed chronologically the events and the dramas of the presidency. But I needed to get these people to sit down with me and let me break out the tape recorder, and they fully understood that their words would be on the page attributed to their name. And that was difficult to do, as you mentioned earlier, since I didn't come from the political world. And it's also difficult to do and ensure that these people are giving you the straight dope, that they're not just giving you sort of fluffy I love Obama material, that they're telling you really about the stress and the work that happened behind
the scenes. And so let me stop you. So why would they? In other words, they know you're writing a book. They know, I'm assuming they knew how you were writing it, an oral history. Their words would actually appear attributed to them. So how do you know you were getting candor from these folks?
Well, that's interesting. I think you can smell bullshit, when it comes across. I would say a couple things. As I mentioned, in a case of, I'd like to bring up Valerie Jarrett for a minute, who was a senior advisor to Obama, sure, and even back in his Senate days in Chicago. And, she plays her cards very close to the vest. She's very articulate. She's happy to discuss policy. But as far as really what's happening in the inner sanctum, you're not going to get much. And that is not her being dishonest. That is who she is. I was grateful for the conversation that I had with her anyway, and she was very informative on just sort of their agenda with criminal justice reform, things that were successful, things that were not. But as far as finding out what was really, really happening, you weren't going to get it from her. But I knew that if I went around to enough people and I got enough people on record, it eventually gives me the upper hand, where if I want to talk to, say, just as a random example, a David Axelrod, and he sees that I've got 95 people on the record, and his name's been mentioned however many times, right? 36 times, let's say,
right,
and I'm telling him all this. He knows it puts him in a bit of a situation where he just better talk to me, because who knows what I have.
Well, I think that was your experience with Mayor Rahm Emanuel of Chicago, right? Since I talk primarily to a Chicago audience, or maybe not, but I think I do. That was your experience with Rahm, getting him to talk to you.
Yeah. His communication staff, I did not reach out to them until I was probably 7-8 months into the project, and I probably had 65 people on the record at that point. And I definitely know that I felt them being responsive to my line about, hey, I've spoken to 65 people, Rahm's name's been mentioned, let's say 37 times, whatever it was. And they understood that it was a legitimate piece of work at that point, and that if he didn't participate, that it would look, it might look weak on his part. I also think, to be fair to them, there was just a straight-up scheduling issue. It, it took me 2 months to get a 20-minute phone call with him.
So, given
you're the mayor of Chicago, yeah. Brian Abrams is low on the list.
So, given that you talked about 115 people, I know you contacted over 200. You didn't get to everybody. I didn't see the name Larry Summers in the book, Greg Craig. So,
right.
There's some missing names. My question is, in the end, when you finish the book, did you look and go, well, there's just going to be some gaps here from people I didn't get to talk to or wouldn't talk to me? Or did you fill in any gaps you had in your head about the story that had to be told from somebody else?
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't call it a gap. Okay. I think if you sit down and you read the book, it's a cohesive and smooth story that you really genuinely feel like I just experienced the entire presidency. Now, having said that, there were storylines that I knew I couldn't get to, and there were storylines I just couldn't get, but I also wanted to be really aware of pacing, and I wanted this book to be no longer than 500 pages. I felt that that had a certain weight to it that, you know, was sort of classy enough that was deserved of a book about a presidency.
Sure.
But I didn't want to turn it into some giant Tolstoy thing, there's a bit of both. It's, you know, did I get the story of how the Obama administration failed to successfully address the housing crisis in the Treasury Department? No, I did not. And, you know, but did I also manage to get a story about, you know, their agenda on climate change throughout the entire presidency and stories there that were never told before? Yes. So, you know, there's a bit of a trade-off, and you just have to kind of make a call. I wrote this oral history about David Letterman, you know, years ago that you mentioned, and that's another instance, very more lighthearted instance, but it still works here, where I had readers email me and say, hey, how come you didn't include the episode about XYZ?
There's always something else.
You're not going to get everything.
Well, one voice that is missing from the book is Obama's voice, and mm-hmm. And I'm sort of curious, was it he wouldn't talk to you, or he would taint the story too much, or you didn't want it from his point of view? What was the theory?
Yeah, I was in touch with the post-presidency office, and I was in touch with the Obama Foundation throughout the writing of the book, and they were helpful in getting me people. I never made the ask to talk to Barack Obama, and, the feeling really was that I almost felt as if it would be awkward to have him in the book. I don't know if he would have done it or not, to be honest with you. Maybe, maybe not. What's a 20-minute phone call, you know, that we could schedule over, you know, a period of months? I mean, if Rahm could do it, you know, a retired president probably could squeeze it in too.
Well, that's why I asked, was it the voice you didn't want to have in the storytelling?
I think so. When, you know, imagine you're in a narrative in the book about, say, immigration reform, and one of the policy people in the White House is talking, and they're giving you something revealing and smart, and then a Republican senator chimes in and says something, and then all of a sudden, Barack Obama shows up in the book, and I think it just feels like, like a cannonball dive into the pool, and it just kind of, I think it distracts the reader.
I know you started writing the book in 2016, so basically, I think it was before Trump took office, right?
Right.
And so, having said that, I'm just sort of curious, the influence behind the book, because you are, as I said up front, you're a pop culture writer. You wrote the book about Letterman. I know you did write a book, which I really want to read, Party Like a President, and talk to you about that one day. So it's not that you are out of the world of politics, but a lot of what you do is from that pop culture perspective. This is not. So I'm sort of curious, is there a deep political side to you where you said, look, we're about to have a president who is going to dismantle everything Obama did, and I want to get into this oral history? What was the motivation for this book, given your background?
Sure. Well, I would say a couple things. So the contract I got for the book was in, I believe, spring of 2016. So everyone in the world assumed Hillary Clinton was going to be president. I had done three oral histories by that point that were all in the pop culture realm. I was definitely hungry for something heavier and something that required a little more, detail, in this case, like government policy. And also, if you remember, in the spring of 2016, a lot of the media and by extension, you know, the public became consumed by the political space. So, you know, I may have been working in pop culture for years, but by that time I was running a website called Death and Taxes. It's gone now, but we became a fully fledged political blog because of the election. So I think a lot of people's heads were sort of, turned in that direction. And, you know, if, in the case of me, I guess if my knack was oral histories at the time, it felt pretty organic to look to Washington.
You know, the other books that have been written at this point about the Trump presidency, Fire and Fury, and Woodward's book, which you mentioned, Fear, talks so much about how communication works within the White House and just really what a crisis state it seems to be in all the time. What did you learn about the communication styles in the Obama White House? How are they different from what we see today?
Certainly, the dysfunctions you see in the White House communications-wise, you know, and this has been talked about a lot, as you mentioned, you know, the idea of the actual chain of messaging and the chain of command that's happening in the White House is so dysfunctional that, you know, people's voices at the bottom don't get to be heard at the top and so forth. Even and I'm speaking internally as just like a functioning office. And I think that it creates, I think it creates grievances and a lot of disgruntlements. And, you know, not that there weren't those in the Obama White House as well. And when that happened in the Obama White House, I think people would leak to the press to get their ideas heard if they were being shut down or not, you know, if their ideas or their memos weren't being shared with the right people. But you're seeing that, obviously, you're seeing a lot more leaks in this White House because of the high level of dysfunction. And, you know, they're obviously not staffed up like they're supposed to be either. So even if you are one who's supportive of the Republican agenda, this White House is not operating at the rate or the efficiency that you would want. So, you know, you're I don't know if that answers your question, but that's certainly difference I see.
What becomes clear as you talk is, look, you do have a political point of view. You've got a perspective. And yet, for people that haven't read the book yet, certainly hope that they will read Obama and Oral History soon, you have to wonder how, for example, Bob Woodward, although he tells his story through others, because it is a story through his voice, you kind of get his perspective on things to the extent he's willing to share it as a journalist. In your book, here's an example. So you write about immigration policy, and you have, you know, Illinois Congressman, Chicago Congressman, Luis Gutierrez, and he talks about, he goes after Obama in the book through his discussions with you on Obama's immigration failure, and, you know, it was getting better when the Senate passed its comprehensive bill, it died in the House. But you talked about, or Gutierrez talked about the fact that when notes on these issues got passed on from Obama to Rahm Emanuel, who was his chief of staff at the time, that would suggest Obama didn't care and that immigration therefore got pushed back because his concern was health care and the economy. My question to you is, you can talk about that piece of it, but does your voice come through here? Because what you choose to use from what, say, Gutierrez said to you versus others, was it presented in a way that we hear Brian Abrams' voice? Or did you sometimes write things that say, oh, well, that's news to me. It's not what I would have thought. But, hey, that's what they're saying. That's what they're saying.
Yeah, I mean, I obviously, you know, when you put together a book, as you say, and it's this big jigsaw puzzle of other people's quotes, yes, behind that, I mean, I have a perspective and I want to share it. And to me, as far as like a partisan perspective goes, I really tried to divorce myself from that. I mean, look, I voted for Obama both times. You know, I'm a registered Democrat. I'm happy to share that, but I also think that the work itself reveals that I'm not, I don't approach it as a fanboy. I think that, and I guess when I think about partisanship, and I know that's not exactly what you asked, but it's going to maybe help me answer it to think this way.
Sure.
That I was more concerned and more interested in the critiques from the left than I was, say, why Republicans felt Obama was bad. Just because over time, and as history has shown now, just that the Republican caucus was operating in such bad faith that it's really difficult to take any of their critiques or their rhetoric seriously from that last decade. On the left, however, there was an interesting conversation about a feeling of betrayal of progressive politics from the Obama White House. Now, how much of that is true? How much of that is real? How much of that isn't? Like, all of that is interesting for me to parse through. And if I was capable of doing that, you know, while navigating through these voices like that. So immigration is one instance of that, I think, that you pointed to, where Gutierrez was really angry at immigration not being at the top of the laundry list. And by the time they came around to do something about it, you know, we had lost control of Congress.
Talk about, you know, race has become such a factor. It appears to be such a factor under the Trump administration in terms of the rise of, you know, white supremacists and the neo-Nazis, all this kind of stuff, Charlottesville, all that. And you interviewed Cody Keenan, one of Obama's speechwriters, and there were some comments in the book about race as a factor, with Cody Keenan sort of saying, as I recall, that, that Obama's message wasn't about race as much as it was about policy. But I think you said, or I think Keenan said to you, but the race was a navigation factor in this process. Do I have that about right?
No. I mean, who was Obama's chief speechwriter in the second term, was talking about, there was a couple of passages where he kind of jumps in this conversation about race.
Well, I read the whole book, so
a white guy from Chicago, who had worked closely with Obama on a number of speeches through both of his terms, was really trying to express how Obama himself just wasn't interested in participating in, like, the kind of crazy race baiting that we saw on Fox News, for instance, of, say, birtherism, all the dog whistle stuff. When you think of Obama and you think, I mean, when he became on my radar was, 2004, during his the Democratic convention right. speech for John Kerry. As far back as I remember him, he's someone who's always tried to bridge the divide to a fault. It's interesting that you look at his administration, and I think there was some study last year, or maybe it was this year, that showed that that White House spoke about race less than any White House since FDR. This despite, racial tensions, totally spiking. There's another study that shows that. I'm rambling, but I guess, it's interesting how Obama, I think, didn't want to address it because there was a lot of it that he felt was child's play and he was bored by it. And I think there was another part of him that felt that, he kind of, there were things that he couldn't say that maybe he wanted to.
Maybe because it was obvious because he's an African-American guy. So maybe it's a little tough for him to go there. You do write about, the book also covers so many important topics and events and things. And you point out to December 14th, 2012, which many people say, because you weren't speaking, people speaking, Obama would not disagree, but all the folks you were talking to, was the toughest day they all had in office, one that in which they and he reacted as a parent. And of course, I'm talking about Sandy Hook.
Yeah, Sandy Hook massacre, that when everyone in the White House kind of finds out, like, on their own time by watching TV, or in the case of Obama, with a staffer kind of running into the Oval Office during his daily briefing with his CIA, or with his Homeland Security advisor at the time, about 20 children and a school principal, and I believe some teachers that were gunned down to death, in a quiet little Connecticut school. I think that was just like I think that the country experienced a depression at that moment that we never quite have pulled ourselves out of, emotionally.
And we also haven't done anything about it either.
No. And when you look at, it's funny, you look at that presidency, and he was really frustrated when they couldn't get together gun legislation even in the Senate at that time. And they had worked since December. Since that moment, they had parked immigration reform and spent 3 months traveling, giving speeches, whipping senators to try to get a common-sense piece of gun legislation passed. And there were even red state Democrats that voted no on it. We have so many obstacles, likely because the NRA is sort of this extra arm of the government now that has even made its way into, red state Democrats' office today. Yeah, there's just there's a lot of hoops to jump through on this one. I don't know what to say. It is depressing.
And you write about, again, the raid and the Bin Laden complex. I just have one point I have to make. And, of course, as you know, I read your book completely. And what I love about it, there is, to me, when you think of the photos that come out of the Obama years, I mean, one of the top five photos, in my opinion, is White House photographer Pete Souza's classic photo of the Situation Room during the Bin Laden raid. I just think that's a classic. And yet you write, Pete says to you in the book, he actually says it really wasn't one of his best photos.
Yeah. You're watching Hillary with her, her hand over her mouth. I think she said she was just suppressing a cough. Pete Souza, the photographer for Obama for all 8 years. He was kind of talking about how that photo to him, when he thinks of the great photos of Obama that he has taken, that one does not come to his mind. Although, you know, I mean, look, that is definitely one of the photos I think of as well. But Pete also talks about how we all kind of experienced that moment, in a very dramatic way, and yeah. So we're projecting when we see that room, you know.
So, Brian, so this book, it's a look back, although actually it says an oral history from 2009 to 2017, but as you indicated, and I was going to make this point anyway, it really goes back before then. You really do start in 2004 with that speech. We do get a little bit of his earlier years prior to a presidency, because those years obviously served to make the man and lead to the president. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. Trump talks about his background as a real estate developer. Well, that wasn't Obama's background. We need to understand that as well. And you... Mm-hmm. You present that. My question is, as this book now, and it's in my hand, as this book now stands here as a large book, as a thorough book, was it written about memorializing the past? Was it written with an eye towards the future? What was the purpose in that way?
You know, to me, and what I get a lot, I hear a lot of people who buy the book and who talk like highly of the book, like they frame it in a way where people want to wax nostalgic. They want to look back to a time when the president was good, blah blah blah. And that's fine. That's really not. I guess I never really had that in my mind. I'm aware that the publisher also would probably like to market it as that, but I just never thought of it that way. To me, I wanted to make this, you know, a document that helps us understand, and I want to know what happened in the last 10 years that brought us to this place that we're in now, and I want to know what happened in the last 10 years that saved us from what could have been even worse, economically, for instance. So that was it for me. I wanted a piece that could definitively help people go back and get a strong handle on just what the hell happened when the majority of us didn't have to pay attention to politics.
Good point. The book is Obama, an Oral History, 2009 to 2017. And the author is Brian Abrams. If you haven't read it, check it out. Again, it's a story told through the words of others. And you know exactly who's speaking in the book. It's a really unique perspective and a really unique approach to this. Check out his other works, too. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Abrams. You can also check out his website at brianlabrams.com. Perhaps get one of his other books. I still want to read a couple of those. As you know, the Letterman book and the Partying About Presidents book. That's got to be fun. Brian, congratulations on this book. Continued good luck with it. And I hope everybody who's listening gets a copy and takes a read. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you.
Yes, it is magic. It is very fun magic. It is a Chicago treat and treasure that you might not know about, but you should, because, it's only been around for a period of time in Chicago since earlier in the year. It's called the Chicago Magic Lounge. It's at 5050 North Clark Street, but I want you to know what it's all about, because I got to tell you, you're in for a real treat in terms of exploring this, spending an evening. What a great place to take a family, your friends, have a party, on and on about what you can do at the Magic Lounge. So joining me to talk about this incredible place that I have had a chance to visit is the co-owner, the CEO of this place, who I think has talked magicians into teaching him their tricks, Joey Cranford. Joey, good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. Thanks for having us on.
And the director of entertainment, he's also a magician, Benjamin Barnes. Ben, I wish I could make you do some tricks for me. I can't make it happen right now.
Next time.
All right. Joey, what led to this? It's almost like there's just been a surge, because there are some places to get magic around town. This is something that has history to it in terms of a movement, right?
Right. I got involved with the magic community maybybe 7 years ago. And from my theatrical world, I saw that there was nothing kind of tying the whole magic community together, like there is in the comedy worlds and stand-up worlds and the improv worlds. There was no real roof that all of these magicians would meet under except for at magic shops. And I wanted to kind of explore that. And at the same time, I was reading a book called Now You See Them, Now You Don't, My Life in the Magic Bars of Chicago, written by a magician named Bill Weimer, who played a lot of old magic bars. And I was learning about this this history that's kind of untapped in Chicago about the magic bar movements. And so that was from 1915 into the 30s and the 40s. By the time the 80s hit, we had 9 magic bars open at once, and then they all kind of went away. And I wanted to kind of dive into that and find out why they left and what happened to them, what they were like. And my love for magic at the same time, this all kind of created this perfect storm to try something new.
And Ben, what I really loved about my experience there, and of course everybody will have the experience when they go there, it's this is not about going to see Penn and Teller. All due respect, I love Penn and Teller, but it's not about going to see Penn and Teller or some, you know, or David Copperfield on stage in Vegas, where we're filling the room with elephants and then making them disappear and all of that. What's really cool about this show is, and I think this is a Chicago thing, I believe that one of the magicians mentioned when I was there that night, that this close up magic, the ability to be right on top of things with the audience, that too is a Chicago thing.
Absolutely. As one of the performers we had and recently said, close-up magic, as we think of it today, was invented in Chicago. Bar magic was invented in Chicago. So, when you come here, you're seeing something that is, you know, very much a product of the city, and it's nothing quite like it in the world.
As I said, great place to party. There's always, and I'll ask you kind of for the schedule, although we'll give the website as well so people can check it out, because there's different events all through the week and different, you know what, let's just go there. Joey, talk to me about the different kinds of events that happen during the week, because you're not seeing the same thing. You can go 7 nights in the week and have a different experience.
Correct. That's kind of what we wanted. We wanted your experience to be different every time you come. The table magicians, we do have house performers, but we add to that a lot. Those are the table workers that are performing the table side. We bring in outside acts thanks to Ben's expertise and his knowledge and his friends, really, in the magic community. We're able to really stack the deck with amazing performers. And that's all pretty much centered around our signature show. The show started in 2015 as the Chicago Magic Lounge. And when we created the venue Chicago Magic Lounge, we were like, well, what do we call our show now? So that's how we earned the name the Signature Show. And that Signature Show is 5 magicians working the table, 5 to 6 magicians working the table, 2 magicians working the stage, a magician at the bar early, and then a late-night bar magician, and then a magician as well performing close-up in the 654 Club for the upgraded seats. So you could see 10 to 11 magicians a night during our signature show. But Wednesdays, we also have different programming for Wednesdays. We have a magician currently, our artist in residence, David Parr. David's done magic for years in Chicago with his show at the Greenhouse Theater, Magic Cabaret. And he just he wanted to kind of hit a reset button, and we were the perfect place to do that. And so now Wednesdays, he does his one-man show. He just got off of television. He fooled Penn and Teller on Penn and Teller's Fool Us. So it's just really great to have someone like David as part of our team. Mondays and Tuesdays, we slow it down a little bit and change gears. It's not all about magic. We celebrate jazz. So we play live music with jazz artists all over the city. They come here on Mondays and Tuesdays. It's a cover charge to get in, but we also do tableside magic. It wouldn't be Chicago magic, you know, without that tableside feel. And so it's not a quiet, kind of stuffy place. It is kind of like a party with jazz and close-up magic and a little magic on stage as well. It's $10. It's a great price. And then Sundays is the only day we let the under 21 set in. A lot of people say, well, my kids want to come. You know, I know kids love magic, so we wanted to make something work for them too. So it's a 2:00 matinee for kids and families.
So and the rest
it's a full schedule, 7 days a week.
And the rest of the week you make the kids disappear.
We do our best.
You know, it's not just, Ben, it's not just, there are a lot of, so as you're sitting there, I want to talk about my experience in a minute, but so as you're sitting there, various magicians, this is in the cocktail, the sort of a close-up magic period, you're kind of at the table, and if you're doing the little upgraded seats, and magicians are coming by to introducing themselves to you. I met Magic Sam and some other folks who'd come by and show things. Oftentimes it's card tricks, oftentimes it's coins, it's the kind of thing, or ropes, it's things you might expect. But then when you get to that stage show, you'll have people like Mark Toland, who's a mind reader. So it's not all about cards and whatever. I still don't understand how mind reading is done. So Ben, I was hoping you would explain to the audience right now how they do that.
You know what?
Sorry, we're losing you. We can't hear it. What was that?
We lose the connection. No, I know you can't tell me, Ben, but I do want you to speak to the fact that you do make sure that in these shows there is a variety of stuff going on. It's not like one guy's card trick and the next guy's card trick, and that's all you're ever going to see.
Right. And that's by design. The magic that you see at the tables, you do see a lot of cards and a lot of coins, and like you said, things that you expect, but even the style of the performers doing that type of magic is wildly different. The stage acts that you see, there's a lot of contrast, and then when you go into the back, the 654 Club, if you do the upgrade, again, it's more variety. So my goal when putting together these evenings is to give the audience a broad sense of what magic is in its totality. And we make everything as different as we can so people see lots of different things throughout the night.
I'm going to do one more thing on this mind reading. So, because Toland, and I've seen other mind readers, they kind of blow me away. And so you're, and they'll do things like call you up. I mean, look. Audience members are always trying to figure out how the magician, he's hiding this, he's palming that, right? That's what we do. That's our job as audience members, is try and guess the trick. The mind reading thing, though, I mean, even some of it, I'll try and work my way there. But when he says to you, you know, think of an event that you had or something that was a great thing that happened this year, and then come up and he tells you what that event is, and I'm thinking, what? There's no earpieces. I just don't know how this is happening. So here's the only question I'll ask you, Ben. Do you do mind reading, or do you have a background in that, and you understand it as well?
You know what? I understand if it's entertaining, but I don't understand how it works.
Oh, so that's not part of what you do?
No, not at all.
And Joey, have you been able to talk, because you pay these people, have you been able to talk them into telling you how they do it?
Of course. I mean, come on. Well, here's the started this business?
This is the only question I have. When I was a little kid, I would get magic tricks like the magic rings, you know, and the balls and the cups. I'd buy those kind of things. And the disappointment always was, because it was always cool when the magician did it. And then when I learned what the trick was, I went, that's all? All of a sudden, it's like, yeah. Well, you got to know how to do it. But I'm just curious, if I knew how the mind reading was done, if either of you can answer, would I go, oh, that's it? Or would I go, oh, man, that's unbelievable?
You know, a lot of times knowing the secret is it just kind of lets you down.
Yeah.
Because, you know, magic is not about the trick to us. It's basically a way of engaging with an audience. It's just a means to an end in that sense. There's so many different ways to do it, but they all involve the same. So your magic kit could have easily provided you with a tool that could have led you to perform a mental feat.
Wow.
But it's the eloquentness of the performer and how smooth they are with everything, implying the same principles as any old magic trick: misdirection and timing and just entertainment.
All right, smooth answer.
There's a lot that goes into it, a tremendous amount of work that goes into it. We like to kind of, there's some magicians will say it's a sleight of mind. In that sense, where they are hiding something, you just don't know where.
Right. And I keep looking for it. Well, Joey, let me ask you. Here's where I'm not going to give anything away. Because, first of all, I went to the 10 o'clock show. So there's an earlier show. I think it was like 7, right? Is that the 7?
It's 7:30 and 10.
Okay. So for the 10 o'clock show, I got there about 9. And I actually thought, oh, my God, I'm just getting here so early. What am I going to do? I got nothing to do. Well, I'm glad I went early. From the moment I sort of entered the place, but here's where I don't want to give, I don't want to say some things and go, oh, I wish you hadn't said that. So I'm going to turn it over to you. If I'm on my way to come to the 10 o'clock show, I got there about 9. I mentioned you were at 5050 North Clark. What do you want to tell me about my arrival at the Magic Lounge?
We try to throw you off guard, right whenever you come in. It's not like a theater show where, you know, you have to wait until the doors open. We want you to come in and have a few different experiences before your show begins. It is kind of redefining what a show is, what a magic show is, and what it can be. A lot of people think a show is I buy a ticket, I come in, I sit down, and the show starts.
And that's what I thought. That's why I was like, oh, crap, I'm here early, but I'm glad I went early.
We're more interested in creating an experience for our guests that begins at the main door. When you walk in, you might walk right out not knowing that you found us.
Right.
The building was historically a commercial laundry in Andersonville for many years, and a lot of people remember it as a commercial laundry. So we wanted to pay a little bit of homage to the history of the building since we are doing a send-up to magic history in Chicago. The whole thing is kind of history. And so when you walk in, you walk into a laundromat. It is a no-frills, black and white tile laundromat. And we offer you a little puzzle to figure out. And you have to figure out how to get inside. There's no one out there opening a door for you. We do have some closed circuit. In case you're a little bit confused, we can open it up. But once you enter, then you are swept away into this just really stellar Art Deco design speakeasy bar. And we have a magic library that you can peruse some artifacts. You can see the original pieces we have on the wall, the Houdini artifacts, and then also just walk in and see magic right at the bar. And that's kind of one of our neat things is you don't have to have a ticket to come in. You can actually go through and have that experience and watch magic at the bar, get some cocktails, and then go to the next thing in your evening. But most people do have a ticket when they enter, and so when it's time for seating, we make an announcement to make your way into the library, and then another secret door reveals itself to you, and that's when you enter into the cabaret.
I'm glad you told it, because I wasn't sure you'd even give away the laundry part, so you did. I'm just curious. I know you said you have closed circuit.
That's kind of a big thing.
Yeah.
We won't tell you how it opens.
I know, that's right.
How you get in.
I'm leaving that to you. I will have one follow-up question, which is, so I walked in, but I had been told by the folks who, were bringing me to you, they sort of said, now you're going to enter a laundry. So I kind of knew, but I'm curious. Do you ever see somebody who, like, oh, we're in the wrong place, they turn around and you got to go chase them?
Yeah. Well, we don't have to chase them. They usually come back because the address is on there, 5050 North Clark, and there is a clue in there that you're in the right spot.
Okay.
You know, we don't have signs that say Chicago Magic Lounge. We thought that was just a little too obvious.
Yeah, that's part of the fun. So, by the way,
if you look in one of the dryers, the shirt tumbling in there is the Chicago Magic Lounge T-shirt.
Okay. See, I missed that. I didn't even see that.
A lot of small details in that room.
Yeah. So this may be a Joey question, but I'm going to come to Ben for it. So here's the thing. Not only are the magicians doing their thing, but while we are sitting and watching the first of all, there's that cocktail hour, so you've got that going on. You do have the bar outside. But during the close-up magic, I should say, there's also food available, Ben, and the magicians are coming around while you're having a little snack.
Yeah. And the magicians and the servers are trained to work in concert with each other. So when the servers appear, they will wait. If the magician is about to do something spectacular, they'll give that performer a moment to get through that, and then they bring the food on. And the food, as Joey can tell you better than me, is equally spectacular. We have a great menu. It's a small menu, but yeah.
So, and one more question for you, Ben, which is, look, so I'm at the late show, right? And I understand from talking to some of the performers afterwards, because the evening I was there, there was a fairly large party, which is wonderful. I'm so glad. I want you to have large parties. They clearly had been drinking quite a bit prior to things. I won't mention the name of the party, although I know it. And for the group that I was with, we now talk about them evilly as we sort of like they're now our version of what, you know, the people like, oh, those evil people. Anyway, my question is, but I thought the magicians handled that group whose last name began with the name of a president that followed. Anyway, oh, shit. I'm so mad at those people. Anyway, but the thing is, I thought the magicians, everybody handled them, and I did stay around for the 654 Club, which I'll ask you about in a second, but the magicians handled them so well. There was no, you know, no, hey, shut up, you, and whatever. It's just the magicians play to it, and I was told by one of the guys, one of the headliners I was chatting to, he said, you know, the late shows, you tend to have that. We're good with it. We understand.
Yeah, and that particular group was funny. I didn't know they were going to be there, but I performed at their wedding. So I didn't know they were coming, but I knew all of those people. When I saw that they were a little tipsy, one of the performers, the performing at 654 Club, wanted to know if he could handle that and how to handle that. And we spoke about it. And, our performers are professionals. They've dealt with similar groups, so they know just how to handle audience members like that without being too harsh.
No, that's what I thought was so great. And in that way, they're like the Vegas performers or anybody. Because, look, you get hecklers everywhere you go. Now, by the way, I should say, this party, apparently good friends of yours, this party were not heckling at all. They were just were having a good time. And that's lovely. But I compliment all the performers and how they handled it. So, Joey, or either one who wants to answer this, but the 654 Club. I've seen this other magician who kept referencing the 654 Club, and I didn't realize at that time it's a thing. So tell me where the name the 654 Club comes from that you use for your special show at midnight.
Again, you know, we're all tying into the history of Chicago magic, and there was a place called the Ivanhoe that had a magic bar in it, the Black Knight Bar, later renamed Frank Everhart's Magic Bar. And there was a magician named Frank Everhart who had made popular a trick that had gone by a lot of different names, but he solidified it as Sam the Bellhop. And it's a story trick, and, you know, there's things that happen that correlate to the cards that are being dealt. For instance, the narrator says, Sam, you know, I'm looking for some guys to play poker with. And Sam goes one block, two blocks, three blocks, and at this time the magician is cutting the cards. And he came back, and he had four guys, all named Jack, and he deals out the four Jacks. And he says, where'd you find these guys? He says, well, they were hanging out down at the 654 Club. And as he's doing that, he's dealing out the six and the five and four. And so everything that happens in this story, well, this is incredible. What's going on, Sam? Where are you finding everybody? Well, I told you, the 654 Club. And so it appears about three to four times in the trick, depending on who's telling the story. And then there was a magician who came along named Bill Malone. And Bill Malone is probably the most successful Chicago magician, the biggest name in Chicago magic. Even though the public doesn't really know him that well, he is a massive name in magic. Makes his living doing corporate gigs, and he started a magic bar down in Florida. Well, he worked these old magic bars. He took that trick, Sam the Bellhop, and turned a trick into a miracle. He's shuffling the cards the entire time this trick is going on, and he just has so much fun with an audience, and he's always dealing out that 654. And so I knew we were going to make a special close-up room, and I thought, what a cool name to actually build the 654 Club. So really it's an inside joke to magicians just to make them giggle at the fact that in Chicago you can actually visit the 654 Club.
But it's
It's just saying it's got a cool kind of ring to it.
And it does. And by the way, Ben, magicians come, the Magic Lounge is not just for the public who want to come enjoy everything. Magicians hang out there, right? That's what's so special about it for magicians, and they get to share and trade and talk.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the great things about Joey's vision. He really did create a place where the magic community could gather and, like you said, exchange secrets and work on material and just enjoy magic as part of the audience. Yep.
It's great fun. Well, you got to check it out, folks. It's the Chicago Magic Lounge at 5050 North Clark Street. And don't let the point that you won't see it when you get there throw you, because it's really there. And check out the schedule. Joey, give me the website so people can, because you can get your tickets, you can get everything there.
All right, get your pins ready. It's yep. ChicagoMagicLounge.com.
Now, that's real tough, right? I just wanted you to say it. And again, the magicians I saw were wonderful. So many of them walk around. They're friendly. They're nice. I talked to some of them afterwards. Really great. And if you're going to go, by the way, if you go to the late night show, by the way, that upgraded ticket thing at midnight in the 654 Club, is there a similar version of that in the 730 show, or is that just the late night show?
It's the same thing. All signature shows have that upgraded 654
okay.
Club package.
Well,
some of our special shows as well. We have a Halloween show coming up, and we're going to use the 654 Club for a live Victorian era séance.
Ooh, I love that.
Yeah.
This will be good. Check them out. It was really, what a great fun. And the thing is, people are always looking for something to do. Yeah, obviously, you know, I promote theater. People should see shows and all that and go to dinner. Enjoy the city. It's so great. But if you've never done something like, going to a magic show, then the Magic Lounge with the Harry Blackstone Cabaret, the 654 Club, so many different things that happen to you while you're there and events. It is an experience. And there's no wonder that people bring their parties in their large groups and enjoy it because it's great fun. And I congratulate you on establishing something that, I mean, anybody I know coming to Chicago, I'm going to say, you got to check this out. It's just something that I think in Chicago you got to do.
That's wonderful. That's so great to hear.
Gentlemen, thank you for your time. Joey Cranford. And Benjamin Barnes, if there's a magician listening who says, I'd like to perform there, do they contact you there to, like, audition or something and try and get a gig?
Yeah. The first step is just to shoot me an email, and my email is benjamin@chicagomagiclounge.com.
Easy enough. I can do a trick like where, you know, as long as I bend the ears of the cards, I can make it. I don't know if that impresses you or not.
You know what? Let's talk about it later.
Gentlemen, thank you.
Giving away secrets.
I know. I'm giving all secrets. Right. He bent the cards. How did he figure that out? The Chicago Magic Lounge, 5050 North Clark at ChicagoMagicLounge.com. Check it out, guys. You guys are great. And I do believe in magic. And I do every time I see it. And I certainly believe that the whole night I spent with you guys. Thanks so much. I appreciate you.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, @PaulLisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more Insider Scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.